Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is another stonking summer podcast from Celtic Underground. Is there a better introduction to any music ever than the introduction to Superstition by Stevie Wonder? Answers on a postcard, or you can email in to podcast@celticunderground.net. Anyway, yes, email in a song, tell me it's better intro than that, and you're talking garbage. But you can have a go, you can vote, and Stevie will win it. Anyway, enough of me, getting on to the podcast. This guest, I'm biased. I thought it was a brilliant podcast. Really enjoyed the interview. Playwright, author, producer, director, actor. He'll introduce himself, tell you all the work he's been involved in. You might not know some of the stuff, and then you go, ah, right, okay. He's rewritten the lines of Lisbon Play, which has just taken its summer break, and we're back on in the autumn. Go online, see how you can go and see it. But I'll let you listen to him and he'll introduce himself. So, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Martin McCarthy. Wash your face and hands. Let me go to the problem. Do all that you can. So I'm here now for a podcast where I'll just let the guest introduce himself. So I'll let you introduce yourself.
My name's Martin McCarthy. I'm currently working as a producer on River City, but I've spent the last maybe 30 years as an actor and writer and Celtic fan. Right from the very beginning of my second year at drama school, before you even asked me a question, it was 1985. And I was down in London, and Celtic were playing Dundee United in the cup final. Mm-hmm. So my pal Luigi, who is part of the Kirkluke Shamrock bus that we were founder members of, told me he had me a ticket. But I was the lead part in a play at drama school at that point, and it was like they were saying it's a sort of really important role, and you need to spend all your time doing it. So obviously I came up in the train on the Friday, thinking what I should. There's a rehearsal on the Sunday, so I just came up on the Friday. Jumped into my mum and dad's house for my breakfast. Went away with the guys. Celtic won with the Frank McGarvey header. Mm-hmm. And then I get sucked into knocking down, as I should have, as a professional person on the Sunday. I never made it to the Monday. And they told me at that point my love of Celtic was going to get in the way of my career. Mm-hmm. And I had to grow up. So I'll tell you some of the stuff that I've done through Celtic later on, and they were wrong about that, but I understand what they were trying to tell, yeah. But they were wrong.
What was the play?
It was Fears and Miseries of the Third Reich, Bertolt Brecht play.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it was probably the first time I wasn't doing a Scottish or an Irish accent, I was right. English in it. So the Sunday was actually me with the person who was going through that with me, supposed to be. And it's before mobile phones. Mm-hmm. So he just turned up and I wasn't there, so it wasn't very good. Well, having said that, he was a football fan, he's a Fulham fan,
right.
And he got it, he understood why, yeah. It was why I was sucked into knocking home. As my mum says, her memory of it is she saw me for breakfast and she saw me like later on.
So you've given a flavour there that, you know, one of the things we have to do in the podcast is get someone to set out their Celtic credentials to justify being the Celtic Underground podcast. So you've given a flavour there because you just said you put Celtic before your career.
but we'll just reconfirm your Celtic credentials. Who was your first Celtic hero and what was your first Celtic game?
My first Celtic hero was Billy McNeil, because my dad comes from Moss End in Bells Hill, where mm-hmm. Billy came from, and Billy went to a ladies high school, which was the same school I went to, and he was my hero, even to the extent, as much as I love Jimmy Johnson, I voted for Billy as my favourite of all time.
Right.
When the vote happened, Billy is my all time Celtic hero. First game I went to was Celtic 6 Clyde 1, which might have been 1972, mm-hmm. When I would have been like 7 or something like that. Most of the Lisbon Lions were playing. I was taken by my uncle Jerry McGuinness, God rest him, who was a massive Celtic fan. And after we'd scored the third or fourth goal, when I cheered the fifth, he made me sit down and he said, "No, you don't cheer that way now. We're now humiliating them, so you don't do that when you're Celtic." So that was my first game. The first really big game for me was the 75 Cup final. Mm-hmm. I got taken to that Celtic Airdrie 3-1 game.
Yeah, and your hero's last game.
Yeah, my hero's last game. Yeah, that was a very memorable occasion for me. I still remember the whole thing. Getting there and handing my uncle Neil, who was my dad's uncle, used to turn his car off going down the hills. I really remember.
See, with a bit of petrol. So, given a flavour of your upbringing, you're from an area obviously that's a football area. So, how does someone like you get into a position where 10 years after that cup final, you're having to decide between an acting role and Celtic?
It was really strange. We moved to Kirkluck when I was in my last year at primary school, mm-hmm. and Kirkluck is a place I would still call home, even though I've not lived there now since I was 19. I still go back often, yeah. because the people there, the Celtic supporters there, are amazing. And when I grew up, it was quite a divided town, mm-hmm. So I didn't really have a friend who was not a Catholic, mm-hmm. genuinely, until I was drinking age, because mm-hmm. they were all in teams that wore a variation of red, white and blue, and our team, St Athanasius, wore the old West Brom strip, which was green, white and gold, mm-hmm. so it was like red rag to a bull in a lot of those games. But a lot of those guys that played in those football teams with me and that I grew up with I'm still very close to. But what happened was, when I was 17 or 18, I injured my hand. I cut the tendons in my hand there and couldn't do the sports stuff that I was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. And my brother, Brian, who's an actor, had just sort of done one show. And he said, "Well, why don't you come down and help out with this show? You meet loads of girls," is what he said. And I went down, and then I was cast in the part of Judas, and my brother, Brian, was Jesus in Godspell. Mm-hmm. And it was quite a successful wee thing. And I got a taste for it, and very quickly somebody asked us to audition for the National Youth Theatre in London, and I got in, and then when I went down I got cast as Macbeth. Mm-hmm. So that happened very, very quickly, and then when I finished that, I had to decide what I was going to do when I was leaving school, whether I'd been working for Marley Buildings as a labourer during the summers, because my dad was a manager there. And he was like, "Do you want to do this for the rest of your life, or do you want to go to uni, or what do you want to do?" So the plan was I was going to go to uni until that happened. And then there was a group called the On Your Bike Group in Cumbernauld, which was a group for unemployed young folk to become actors. Mm-hmm. So I had to audition for that, and I get in, and there was loads of folk. Frank Gallagher, who plays Lenny Murdoch,
yeah.
who's in The Lions of Lisbon that mm-hmm. I'm doing just now, he was in that, so we've known each other since then. And I auditioned for drama school at that period as well and got in down in London. Mm-hmm. And that all happened in the space of maybe 12 months. It was very, very quick. When I was down in London 6 months into being at drama school, I thought I'd made the biggest mistake of my life.
Right.
Because I had nothing in common with anybody mm-hmm. that was there. Well, one person, a guy from Liverpool, everybody else had no idea. They were talking about Arnold Wesker and all these writers I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. I just had to get in and learn about that, but at the same time I still didn't want to lose my identity, which Celtic is a huge part of. And the degree that I did, you got to write a play in your third year, so I wrote the play based on something to do with Celtic. Mm-hmm. So that's why they thought I was kind of obsessed. But it was the point was, it was in London and I missed Celtic. Mm-hmm. I missed the whole social thing, but I missed being at the games, and I just felt like an alien.
But shouldn't, when you hear authors talking about writing books, one of the things they talk about is write about a topic you know.
Yeah.
Because you'll give it realism that you can't do if you're tapping into it. Well, so surely that's a positive that you know.
Well, I know, but I think what it was is that they were trying to say, at that time, we were trying to make me into an actor who would walk around normally speaking in a received pronunciation accent, mm-hmm. so you wouldn't know what I was, whether it was Scottish, Irish, English, or anything. It was that standard English accent. I just didn't want to do that because I felt your accent and where you come from is part of you, mm-hmm. and that's part of you as an actor, so I didn't want to do that. So there was a whole rebelling thing going on with me with that, and I didn't want to accept being told that that's how my career would have to be if I wanted to be an actor. I felt as if, exactly as you've said, a lot of things I'll do will come from what I know, mm-hmm. and Celtic was a huge part in it, and still is.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking there, I mean, one of the things I often think about must be the most challenging thing when you get into acting is that shedding that complete self-awareness of doing something. You know, you talked earlier about the play in 85, the Bertolt Brecht play, about using a non-Scottish accent. How do you overcome that? Because I find part of the reason I ask that is because I think Scottish people in general, we talk about gallant Scottish people, but actually we can be quite a self-deprecating and as a society and as a group of people to not really put ourselves out there. So how do you overcome that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that, and I think it's difficult. When I was, certainly the first whole year I was in London, I think I was quite shy, self-deprecating about a lot of things because I thought they all knew more than me, mm-hmm. and they actually did, because the education system there did a lot more drama than I had ever mm-hmm. done. So that was actually true. But then I realised all I have to do is catch up with them, and then I've got other stuff that they haven't got, is the way I thought about it. And when you're doing a part, and even at that stage, what I thought was, well, take yourself out of the equation and think of who this is. Mm-hmm. And if you're thinking of who this is, then you're left behind and you don't have that self-conscious thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like separating yourself from what it is that you're doing.
So how did you move from that, being at drama school, and obviously you've done the play, we've talked about 1985... Now, by the sounds of things, that was quite a cut-off point, 1985, if people are saying to you, you need to put Celtic first, or your profession first, and then you said, and I'll get on to all the Celtic things I've done that allowed me to indulge both.
Well, the really weird thing was that then, when I left drama school in 1986, at that time, it was a closed shop thing with Equity, the union, mm-hmm. So when you left, you couldn't get a professional job unless you had an Equity card, and you couldn't get an Equity card unless you had a professional job.
Yeah.
So I was lucky enough that I auditioned for a play that Cumbernauld Theatre were doing, and it was a kind of number one tour, they call it, where it's the big theatres. It was like the King's in Glasgow, the King's in Edinburgh, Her Majesty's in Aberdeen, those kind of big, mm-hmm. and it was a football play,
right.
And it was a fantasy, and it was all about Scotland winning the World Cup. But the first half of the play was about the first Catholic to play for Rangers, because this was prior to Mo Johnson or any of that. So I played that part.
Right.
And believe it or not, the character's name was Davy Murray, which was prior to David Murray over Rangers as well. So in the play, I had to wear a Rangers jersey, signed for Rangers as a Catholic. And then at the end of the first act, I score a penalty against Celtic, and bless myself, was the end of the first act. Mm-hmm. And then the second act, the members of the Rangers board have tried to kill me throughout the play, and so it was like a comedy, you know. Uh-huh. It was great fun to do, but the Kirloch Young Loyalists Rangers bus had my picture with a Rangers strip on their bus for a number of years, as far as I'm aware. So I actually got my Equity card doing that. So I suppose by then I'd went
quite a remarkable, bit of foresight. I mean, one of my friends is a Rangers fan, used to talk about the irony was that Mo Johnston, he used to refer to Mo Johnston as a professional Catholic, because he was one of these Celtic players who went out of the way to bless themselves
True. I mean, years later, there was a series that BBC did called Footballers' Lives, mm-hmm. and I was the writer on that series, and I wrote the Mo Johnston one. Mm-hmm. And Mo Johnston, despite everything and despite what we would say, is a Celtic fan. I'm telling you that for a definite fact. I know that's controversial, but he knows that none of us will accept that, but he is a Celtic fan.
So, just to digress for a minute, because it's one of these difficult things, and I get it. Dispassionately, you look back and say, well, you criticise Rangers for not signing Catholics, mm-hmm. and then you criticise the first Catholic who goes and signs for Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have it always.
No, I know, that's right.
And so I get that. I suppose the element of it was exactly who it was in terms of the Rangers fans, professional Catholic yeah. element of it, and the fact that he had signed for us and then
yeah.
did the deal. How did he justify it himself then?
He justified it himself as a professional decision, and his thing was, he felt, it's in the documentary, that he let Billy McNeil down, but he said Billy McNeil was let down by the Celtic board at the time because mm-hmm. they kept making promises that they weren't coming up with. So he felt as if he was getting led down a blind alley and it wasn't actually going to happen, and he felt he wanted to look after his family. And obviously Souness was one of those, really, I think he was able to persuade him, and Bill McMurdo, mm-hmm. you know, although that's unbelievable, but that Bill McMurdo would be able to persuade MD about anything, but he was able to persuade him. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I mean, I think his career after having done that, although he did score goals against us and all the rest of it, it never went where it should have went,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, because the first time he was with Celtic, I thought he was a tremendous player. I thought Ryan McLear was a better player, my own opinion, but I thought he was great, and I really, really thought he was someone that could go really far.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that move stalled a lot of his career till he went to America,
mm-hmm.
and had a sort of second wind.
Yeah,
but he never made it. Never did end at Everton. Never did end at Hearts. Never did end at Falkirk. Just never, it never happened for him after. In my opinion.
Do you think he would, if he had his time again, he would still sign for Rangers?
Well, I mean, I don't know him well enough to answer that, but what I think,
I have to ask you these because he'll never come on this, but I'd never get one from
but I think there are regrets, as well as you're saying earlier, what you're alluding to is the fact that doors opened through that, there's no doubt about
mm-hmm.
it. Scottish football changed in an instant. Souness, for all the much as I can't stand him, I liked him at Liverpool, but he had none of that, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what he was about. He was about football, and he was about getting one over on the rivals in the same way as he wanted to do that with Everton.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the religious aspect was even considered by him. Well, it had been considered, but it wasn't the major point. I mean, I do remember the news at the time with folk burning season tickets and scarves, and there was apparently a bottle in a Celtic bar where folk put money in for the first guy to deck, Mo Johnson, that eventually was given to charity and all mm-hmm. that. But there was a lot of real hard feelings about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the Lions of Lisbon that we're doing at the moment, the plays in 67, set in 67 and 1992, and in the 67 bit there's two characters that say, alright, we talk about our open door policy, so there's one Protestant and one Catholic having this argument,
mm-hmm.
and the Protestant saying, where's the Protestant on the board then with Celtic? Where is that? So we're meant to have an open door, but it's an open door so far, it's
mm-hmm.
still a closed door. And that's all, I think, changed now,
yeah.
but it wasn't then. So it looked like we were the ones who were always having an open door, but it was only an open door so far. That's why Jock Stein had to go away to come back.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, Mo Johnson's paused me there.
Didn't expect that, did you?
No, I didn't. Do you know, to this day, I can still remember going out on the Sunday night with mates, the days before mobile phones and the day before Twitter and everything, and one of my brothers phoning me up and saying, Mo Johnson's signing for Rangers tomorrow. And I remember saying, aye, right. Because he was signing for Celtic, but it was just not.
Yeah, yeah.
It was dragging on a bit, as you say. And then the next day, you couldn't. John Menges, you couldn't get near the papers because the Sun, I think, had
it
all
exclusive.
And then the press conference, and one of the things I remember going through my mind was, I could have cleaned up with people on Sunday night by saying, I bet you Mo Johnson's singing.
No, I mean, because my memory as well is the cup final that year was the year of the Joe Miller goal.
Uh huh. Yeah.
And the whole of the Celtic support were singing something, your alley, we've got Mo, so
yeah.
Morris Johnson, throughout that game, because we thought we had him. And I remember that make me feel ill at the point, that because I was in the crowd that day singing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Frank Gallagher, who's in, the guy who plays Lenny Murdoch, who's in The Lions of Lisbon, him and I spent that afternoon when Mo Johnson signed for Rangers in a pub, just got steaming, because we were just like, we're devastated.
Yeah,
it's hard to get my boy Michael, who I go to the games with, who's now 19, has no conception really. I try to explain to him how.
No, anything that ever comes up on our podcast, you can talk about it, but I don't think you can ever get across, as you say, the
enormity of it.
You know, that's the word, the enormity of it. It was the fact that he was your uber Celtic Catholic, mm-hmm. who blessed himself after scoring goals. Yeah. It was the fact that he had agreed to sign for us.
Yeah.
And it was the fact that that John Spencer had signed for them as a schoolboy a couple of years earlier and sort of started the principle that they break the dam. But I think subsequently has talked about the fact, and I think Murray has talked about the fact that they felt it really broke the dam by having such a big high profile Catholic being the first one, rather than a lesser player who doesn't quite make it into the team. People can't, there were Rangers supporters clubs at the time that were not recognising they'd have won the league,
so
because they were discounting his goals.
I know a Rangers supporter who was a member of one of them, someone was saying, well, nine in a row didn't happen then for them.
Uh-huh.
If that's your facts, if that's what you're saying, you don't include Mo Johnson's goals and the points that happened when you played or whatever, well, you never won nine in a row, did you? So you can't have it both ways.
No. But as you say, we also can't have it to use it as a stick to beat them with and then go bonkers when they then go and sign someone. I suppose it was the nature of who
if you take it from a dispassionate point of view, it was a clever, from Rangers' point of view, it was a absolutely clever way to break down the Jock Wallace, Willie Waddle tradition that was there. It was almost impossible to break down.
Mm-hmm.
They broke it down in one fell swoop. Having said that, I still don't like them for it. Mm-hmm. So you can still not like them, even though you can recognise what it did.
But your point about, you say Mo Jones is still a Celtic fan, often wonder that about players who then go and sign and play for a rival club of who they supported as a boy. Is there a bit of them through their life that remains a supporter of that original?
I wonder if it is. Well, I never went to America when the production team went over to America. The producer said that Mo Johnson could not have been nicer to everybody. He looked after them all, said he was brilliant, but he said when he went to their house, there was a stack of Celtic DVDs, and he said there was about three Rangers ones, and he said, how come you've got all those? And he says, well, because that's the team I support, that's the team I played for them. He says, so it's difficult for me now, but he said that's the team I support. So whether that, I mean, he's the only guy who can answer that for sure. But that's certainly what the producer, who's now an MSP, said.
Right, well, we'll get off Mo Johnson and back on to you. So you go for your first audition and you get that part. So how do you move from that to being a writer and producer? And obviously
what happened was, after I did the play that was sent to that I did at the end of the third year, it won the prize at the college I was at to go to the Edinburgh Festival. Mm-hmm. So we got to do it at the Edinburgh Festival, which is where the people saw me from this production.
Mm-hmm.
To get that, and then I felt as if that play needed a second act, and mm-hmm. it could be a full length play, but I wasn't sure how to do it. And then I spent the first maybe 5 or 6 years getting good work as an actor. I mean, your standard Scottish stuff like Loads of Taggarts and stuff like that, and a lot of theatre, and football came into it a fair bit. I did a one man play called The Beautiful Game, which was written in poetry, so the whole play was rhyming couplets, and it encompassed the whole of Scottish football, but there was a big Celtic bit in that. After I did the Celtic story in 1998, did the Jock Stein story, I've done loads of Celtic things now. The Lions of Lisbon, which is the thing that I've got on at the moment, I did that 25 years ago as an actor.
Yeah.
And then I mean, I suppose professionally it was the wrong choice, but it was a kind of community play. There was three or four professional actors in it, and the rest of the people were community actors. And 3 weeks into the run, it was selling out everywhere, and it was a great reception. I was offered a lead part in a series with Dennis Waterman and an actress called Emma Ray, who was in my year at drama school. So it was her that got me seen for it. And then I got it, and it would mean I'd have to leave the lines of Lisbon. And I debated about it and stayed in the lines of Lisbon and didn't do the Grey Scott did it in the end. But I felt as if I couldn't, because we had another like 5 weeks to go. And I was like, that's going to ruin the whole thing. And bottom line, I was really enjoying it.
What people listening can't do is, I had a smile when you said that, and the reason I smiled is we've just talked about Boris Johnson making the professional choice.
Well, there you go. So,
there you go. Boris Johnson made the professional, in inverted commas, choice of putting his career first and playing for Rangers in his eyes. And there's you.
That's one way of putting it on,
And I would suggest that not continuing in a Celtic play for something is a bigger, bolder thing to do than what Boris Johnson did.
Oof, well, that's a big thing. I mean, it wasn't that hard a decision in the end. I spoke to Frank. Frank's, you know, my oldest friend, really, my closest friend, and he was kind of swithering as well. He was saying it's a lot of money and it's this and that, and he says, but how will you feel when this is now, this, because we'll have to take this off, we'll have to re-rehearse someone else in the role, and all these community centres and everywhere it's going that are all sold out are going to be let down, so how are you going to feel? So
you're blackmailing me. I didn't really have a choice. But no, it was the right
So Jack McGinn should have taken Mo Johnson aside and said, how are you going to feel?
What about the community centres in Bells Hill?
Exactly. But that's quite a, I mean, understand, there's pretty much what you're saying is your professional option was to go and do what I'm sure was a very well paid gig that Dougray Scott then got, but the moral argument was to stay and keep doing the job that you're doing.
I think moral's part of it, but I think the word I'd use is love, because that was the big thing, is I absolutely loved doing it in front of people who loved being there and the whole thing being part of it. And at that point, Ian Old, who was one of the two writers of the play, Bertie's brother was there, so I met Bertie's mother, Bertie, most of the Lisbon Lions. It was an incredible experience. It was like, there wasn't really any comparison. I was like, it wasn't that hard a choice, because I thought, well, where else are you going to be able to meet all these people? I didn't know at that time I was going to do the Celtic story. maybe I'd changed my mind, but it was such an overwhelming experience, and realising that Celtic is and always has been such a big part of my life, because that play that I was talking about was a comedy, and the tagline was, it was about a Scotsman who kidnaps an Englishman to prove how much an Irishman is. And that was called Damaged Goods, and Celtic are huge in the play as well, how that boy feels about Celtic. So I think probably what I realised is all the things that were actually making me want to do stuff were here, or, you know, rather than down in the Midlands doing a thing that's about a canal boat that's no connection to. So probably I'd realised by that point that's not the way my career was going to go. So when you asked the question, how did I get into the writing and all that, after I did that play, we formed a company called Wise Guys, which was all for new writing and theatre, and I wrote a few plays. And then when my daughter Erin was born, I thought, right, how am I going to make more money than I'm making? And I applied, but I'd written a script for television that got rejected. But they were very kind, they told me why. They said theatre's very different from television. So I applied for a job as a trainee script editor at the BBC so that I could learn about writing for telly. And I got it, and then they did a really great 6 months training. And then I took the job for a couple of years, and then I knew how to write for television, so I left to write for television. And my first big thing really was, apart from writing episodes of other people's stuff, was a series called Tinseltown that was set in Glasgow. Was a big break for me. So that's how it kind of went that way. Then as you're doing the various jobs over the years, you end up producing sometimes, writing sometimes. I mean, I was acting last year or a year and a half ago in River City, so I still do that when it fits in. But it's mostly now producing is River City is a full on thing. Doing the Lions of Lisbon at the same time as doing that has been a double full on.
Well, we'll get to the Lions of Lisbon in a minute, but just for us knowing people not in your industry, two things. First up, so what is the difference between writing a play and writing a TV script, even if it's a TV play?
Yeah, because if you're writing a play, it's a lot about language. It's about how people, the speeches that people do. So people can describe things in language that you're not going to see on the stage.
Right.
When it's television, you're thinking in a visual way. So a lot of the time you're taking the dialogue out of it. So my first attempt was people talking all the time. A lot of the time you can tell stories on television without people talking. It's a completely different thing. We have playwrights who then come to try and write for, say, something like River City and find it very, very difficult. In fact, next week we're doing a 3-day course for writers to transition from that to writing telly, because although they're really good writers, it's just a very different medium. I always try to advise people to read, like you do with plays. If you're writing plays, you read loads of plays. Read loads of telly scripts then if you're going to write for telly, because it's not the same thing. You don't have people doing big giant speeches unless it's the end of the series or something like that. So they are quite different. I mean, they're still the same. If you're writing something on a long-running series, you'll be writing characters you haven't created. If you're writing a play, you've created those characters, so you know them inside out. So you have to find a way of using that stuff that you can do there to use for a long-running series. Like The Bill, for example, I wrote for that. I got my knuckles wrapped for that because I had a bunch of Irish gangsters in the episode. And when they called them over, they said, "Simpson, Craig, Gemmell." I'm not kidding, right? And so there was four of them, four Lisbon Lions get mentioned in it. And the guy who was running the show at the time was quite a camp guy who had no idea about football. But I was just unlucky in that a writer had a year before had called one of the baddies Tony Yeboah, who played for Legion at the time. He was a big Leeds fan. And then so they got loads of folk writing in about it. So I had my episode of Tunnels of Rangers fans writing and raging that there was a gang. Simpson Cake.
Loves my lies for a gang.
Murdoch and McNeil.
So if you're then, well, first of all, do you find, you mentioned The Bill there, so that's a good example, is, because I often think this when you see, and it's obviously different writers have to come into something, do you write something and then somebody then pulls you up and say, "I don't know if the character would talk this way," or?
Yeah, I mean, what you have in the long run of things, you'll have the script department and the producers who will know the characters and all that inside out because they're on it. You'll get new writers who will try things with the characters and then you'll go, "Well, she wouldn't do that because, see, like 2.5 years ago, this happened." You'll not know that history. Or people will try and get folk to talk in different ways. Often what you'll get is some writers will have something they want to say, but can't find a character to say it. So they'll just go, "Well, I'll pick that one." And then you'll know that it's not right. It just doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
But in long-running dramas, they're given a storyline, quite a comprehensive storyline, which then they try to make their own within what it is. They've got to try and make it their own, but there's also serial beats that go on to the next episode and have to pick up from the previous episode. So it's that in itself is a kind of talent, really. There's people who are very, very good at it because what they'll do is make sure they watch the programme, whatever the programme is. Lots of playwrights will come in not having watched the programme and think, "I'm a really good writer, so it'll be fine." And it never works.
So if you're writing from scratch, and sorry if some of these are obvious questions, but not having done it, if you're writing something from scratch and it's a play or a TV script, do you sketch out that whole storyline in advance and then build the dialogue around the storyline that you've sketched out?
It can be really different things. I wrote a play that was done at the Odd and More a couple of years ago, basically from a conversation I had with somebody. where I thought that's a really interesting thing they've said. So I thought about a character and who would say that apart from this person, and then I thought about that character and I started to write who that person would be, and then I started to write about who that person would know, and then the story came secondary. It was the characters that came first. Mm-hmm. And then I worked out the story. So it can be different ways. In Tinseltown we were lucky because what we had was 10 actors in a room with myself and the producer and the directors, and we got to improvise with them and get and throw things at them and develop the characters. So by the time I came out the series, I knew the characters absolutely inside out, and I knew the stories inside out. Mm-hmm. I knew what would happen to them. It was amazing. It was like it was because they almost become real when you do that amount of kind of in-depth research. But when you're doing it yourself, it can come from anything. I mean, I wrote a play called From Paisley to Paolo, about three boys that go to a music festival to see Paolo Nutini. One's pretending that he knows him and all that, and that they're going to go there. There's one guy who's really camp, and his big coming out is the fact he's not gay, and it's a comedy thing. Mm-hmm. But the whole point of that was just that my daughter was going to a music festival, and it was all the carry on going round and about the tent and all that.
Yeah.
It just made me laugh, and I thought this would actually be funny on stage.
Yeah.
So that's so it can be anything.
So you talked about Tinseltown there, and you had a group of actors and it sort of built around that. As a writer, how much say do you get if you were to write something for TV or even a play, and how much say do you get and who gets the part? Because I'm just thinking, you talking about a guy said something in a conversation, you then think who would say that type of thing, and the worst thing in the world must be if you're then not involved in choosing that, and it's the complete opposite.
It's not, but see, it's easier for me because I come from an acting background first.
Right.
I think what happens is people who write and that's all they do can be really precious about it. Mm-hmm. If they have an idea in their head, and I think in television and film in particular, what you're part of a team, because there's a lot of other folk going to be the director's way that they're going to be, the vision that they're going to have, the producers, everybody else. You're not the only person involved in it, and it's much, much easier for me because I get it that an actor can walk in the room and can just go, they might not seem right for this part, but they're brilliant, we should just cast them. There was a guy in Tinseltown who was originally meant to be in for one episode, and I didn't want him in it. I was involved in all the casting.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was too good looking for the part. It was a funny part, and I was just like, no, he's too good looking. The director and producer said, look, you've had your way with about three or four folk, we think he's right. So I said fine. Then I saw what he was doing and I thought he was brilliant, so what I did was change the rest of the series to accommodate him in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was brilliant, so I was totally wrong. You can be wrong, and the whole idea is don't be precious about stuff.
Uh-huh.
Don't be like, what you have to do is understand that if it's a team, other folk have got opinions and their opinions might be actually better than yours on many occasions. And when I've done some teaching at University of the West of Scotland in the Conservatoire for writers. Mm-hmm. and when I'm saying to them, you can't be as precious as you're being, because it's not like you're a genius and everybody else doesn't know what's mm-hmm. happening here. You're part of a team, and actually in television, once you've written the script, normally the writer never sees the set or never sees any of it getting done. We are encouraging now that they come on and see things getting done so they can see why things sometimes change, because
mm-hmm.
the actors who know their characters inside out will maybe go, I don't think I would say that because this and they'll have good reasons.
Yeah.
The writers normally don't see that part of the process, and I think it's good for them to see it, because then they see it's not people thinking their stuff's rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
They're justifying why something has to change.
And I suppose, does that come from when the words are living words and they're coming out of people's mouths, and the emotion that people see them is different to the black and white?
Absolutely. And also, like, they'll know historically things about their own character. There was an actress who came up recently for an episode that's not even been on yet, saying, I shouldn't be at that hen night because my daughter was married to the guy who's going to be the groom and I hate him, so I'd never be at this. And she was absolutely right. But actually, practically, what we needed was bodies at that hen night,
mm-hmm.
because we were filming four episodes at the one time, and a lot of other characters were involved in the other two, so we had the quietest, like, hen night. So we just had to make a virtue of a hen night when nobody turned up. So,
so the other thing that, you know, people like myself who consume the product of TV and plays and whatever, but don't necessarily get into it, I know what a writer does, and I know what a director does. What's a producer do?
Well, it's different on different things. Like a film producer will be often the person that comes in with an idea. They'll approach the writer with the idea. They'll say, I want to hear something about this. They'll go and then try and get the funding available to get the script written. Then we'll start to do, I mean, from top to bottom, they'll do a lot of it, producing in a film. In a TV thing, if you're like a producer within the BBC, for example, you could be on a co-production with an independent. They'll have a producer on that side, you'll have a producer on that side, and the BBC producer will be doing the BBC's interest within whatever it is. That can be casting wise, the type of actor you think will sell the programme. At the end of the day, like a producer in River City, what I would do is my normal day when it's filming will be getting picked up at 6:30 with the actors, and probably not out there till 8 or 9 at night every day, including Saturdays, because you're there for changes that may happen on the, because you'll know the scripts inside out, you've worked with the writers on the development of the scripts over the period. At any time you're doing a block of 2 episodes, so those episodes will be getting shot, those ones are ready to get shot, the next ones are at that stage, so you've got an overall view of everything that's happening. You have to do things within a budget, so you'll understand that if you're going to get a guest actor in for that, then you're not going to have them for these episodes. And you're sort of, I suppose, the football analogy would be you're managing.
Right.
You're basically managing all the departments. You're managing the actors. You're managing the writer. You're managing the director, and all the sort of egos and artistic things that go on within that. You'll have a final say really on what's going to happen. Sometimes things will happen where occasionally people will have disagreements. You have to be the arbiter of that, and you have to make the decision in the end. Decision making is a big part of it. Communication between all different departments is a big part of it. I've written maybe about 50 or 60 episodes of River City as a writer, and occasionally I would go in for 3 or 4 months in the story room and work on development of a series or whatever. And how I ended up producing this was I went into the story room for 2 weeks, maybe 2 or a bit years ago, and then stayed for 6 months working in the story side, and then I was asked what they thought was I was producing without knowing I was producing at that point anyway, and they asked me to apply for a position that was coming up that I got. And it does turn out that because I've done the various areas within the industry, I did know what I was doing more than I thought I would, because I looked on producers as bosses. So I suppose that's the way I'm probably one of them now in that area. There's a number of things. Different producers are different. There's 3 of us that work on in River City, and we're all different. We all come from different ways coming through it. They both come from a directing background. So the executive producer would try and use you in the things he thinks that you're best at. So going out and getting new writers, for example, is part of what I do. Casting for actors is part of what I do. And that might not be what the other ones do. They'll be doing other stuff with directors more than I will. So it's like a team thing. But you're basically there to make the unpopular decisions.
So let's get back to the Celtic stuff. And the Lions of Lisbon. So you talked about that was done for the 25th anniversary back in 1992. So how did that come about, and then we can talk about how it's now come about repeated.
What happened was there's a Scottish actor called Gary Lewis, quite a well known actor now, and at that time Gary was just really starting out, but there was a group of us who we used to kid on and call ourselves the Martin Scorsese Celtic bus. We all had season tickets, and Peter Mullen, Davy Mackay, Frank Gallagher, Pat Harkins, was a load of us. We used to hang about at that time, and Gary was one of the ones that was hanging about with us, and they had started doing the Lions of Lisbon, and I think they were a couple of weeks into rehearsal and felt it wasn't going that well. The director was an actress who knew nothing about football. Really nice person, talented, but knew nothing about football, and so it wasn't going well, and they asked Frank and I to come in and help with it. So what we did was, with the 2 writers, we changed the script. Then there was 2 parts that were made for him and I, and so that kind of changed the thing. And then we just worked on it through that period with Willie and Dean, who were both happy for that to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
They are both smashing guys, and both were like, anything that makes it better or anything that makes it funnier or whatever, it's yeah. fine with us. So that's what we did. So it was developed in that way, and then there was a mostly community cast, and I think four professional actors in that first one, and it just went from strength to strength. It was supposed to be on for like 3 weeks, and I think it was on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It was on because people just wanted to see it.
Yeah.
So we took it around community centres, but it went to the Tron Theatre, eventually went to the Pavilion and all. It went right,
mm-hmm.
right
yeah.
to the houses. And Willie and Ian's whole thing was to write about, Ian had loads of stories as Bertie's brother because mm-hmm. he was in Lisbon, and I think he was actually in Bertie's room at one point when they knew Jock Steen was coming because he could hear his limp. So he was hiding in a cupboard at one point, and these were all stories that we were hearing first hand. And then when we were doing our first performance of it, he said, well, I think Bertie's going to bring a couple of the boys, and a couple of the boys were like Bobby Murdoch was there, Billy McNeil, Jimmy Johnson. We were all just like, oh my god, you were just seeing your heroes, and they were all there, and mm-hmm. they were all there to support Bertie because it was Bertie's brother Ian,
yeah.
who'd had quite a difficult life but had turned a corner and became a community activist, and this was one of his first pieces of writing. Mm-hmm. So it was a big, big thing, and Bertie's mother was still alive at the time, and when it was shown, I think it was in Drumchapel, she said she thought I was Irish. I played the Irish guy in it, and when I was off stage and I wasn't Irish, she was really disappointed. but she said this is the best night of my life, and I said why, and she said because Bertie's done his great thing, but now Ian's got a great thing as well,
mm-hmm.
and it involves Bertie. So it was like a big moment for her.
Yeah.
I remember her saying that really vividly.
So you did that. Who decided that it needed to be I mean, obviously 50th anniversary, but who was the decision maker, was on a revisiting of it?
Well, what happened was, I mean, the original version has been done a few times by like amateur companies mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and it's done well. When there was a conversation with Fairplay, the company that put it on, with me about doing it, and I said, well, if we're doing it, I think we need to relook at it, because there's 25 years have happened since then,
mm-hmm.
and if you ignore them, it's like a museum piece. So I met with Willie and Eileen Auld, who's Ian's widow, and I said, if I'm going to do it, this is the way I would like to do it. I'd like to adapt it and have a relook at it, and they both said fine. So what I basically did was rewrite a lot of it and add a lot of it to what's there now, and sent it to them so they could look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't have done anything that they didn't want. If Willie and or Eileen had said, no, I think that's going down the wrong way, I'd have changed it, but they weren't. They were happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they got what I was talking about, because the action takes place in 1967 and 1992. But the 1992 action can foresee a lot of what happens in the next 25 years.
Right.
So that once they got that, they let us see exactly what you're doing. And also I had to try and simplify some of the action, because it was written, as Willie admits, like for like an amateur company.
Mm-hmm.
So it was written in a different way than it would be if it was a professional play, because it's written with a two-hander, two people talking, then another two people talking, then another two people talking, mm-hmm. then another two people talking, not like a normal play. So I had to look at that and work out how you could change some of that and make it more professional, mm-hmm. I suppose. A lot of the original writing, a lot of the really funny original stuff still there.
Right.
You wouldn't change that.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you were changing the context that things were said in. I cut a lot of like big long speeches that I thought weren't required, because they were all informational, and I said that information comes through the action, we don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave me carte blanche to do really what I thought was best, and what I said was I wanted to do this as a Celtic celebration where it can include everybody within the Celtic family, including folk who haven't got a clue
mm-hmm.
about what happened in 1992 or anything like that. So I said, so if we're doing that, we have to have something of now within the play, even though it's set then. So there was a character who originally was called Sean in the 1992 version, who's now called Brendan, and his entire beginning in the 1992 stuff is about the fact there's never been a Brendan. what Brendan has ever played for Celtic. Why wasn't it called Jimmy, or why wasn't it called Bertie? It was like Brendan, and that continues throughout the 1992 stuff until the dad says, "Well, when a Brendan's needed, a Brendan will come." Sort of thing. It's so it's full of knowledge of now.
Yeah,
but at that time, the other way we could have done it was have 67. 92 and now Street Time, but I just felt that would become really confusing, you know, so we just kept the two original time frames. But there's things in the 1992 stuff that's really alluding to what happens now.
Must have been quite a bit of cheese of 92, because it was such dark times in 92. And there was no immediate hope. One of my mates always goes on about, he was never worried in 1992 about Rangers doing 10 in a row. He was worried about Rangers doing, where Rangers are now, he was worried about Rangers doing 15, 16, 17 in a row.
I know. No, well, I mean, there's the father and son in 1992, the father talks about where's the money coming from. Then if they're going to be doing that, where's the money coming from? And the son's basically repeats the stuff that was said at the time. Well, I mean, David Murray's going to build a floating casino, there's going to be 1,000 jobs, there's going to be, that was all said. So it's not, you don't have to write comedy if that's what was said. And so it's, so you're those things that we were afraid of at that time in 1992 are semi-ridiculous now, because the truth came out and what's happened since. But when you place it at that time, the audience are not themselves, because they know.
Yeah, that it's ridiculous. So first of all, because I was going to say, what would be the next project you could see having a story about Celtic? But before we do that, I suppose we need to touch on the play being out and about now.
What we did was, I set it up with a band. Dave Anderson, who wrote the Celtic story with Dave McLennan, who's fantastic, and he's, a couple of his songs are in this production. Maeve McKinnon, who's an amazing singer. Fraser Spears, who's probably one of the top three harmonica players in the world. And Stephen Wright, who's a guitarist and producer, one of the two producers of the show. So what I thought was, I want a music element to it, which wasn't in the original play at all. And it elevates it out from being like just a play to like a celebration, which is what I wanted it to be. So the play opens with three songs before the action of the play even starts. I did it as rehearsed readings because there's a cast of 11. So what we thought was, if we cost how much it was going to cost for us to do a tour, which would only have been maybe for 3 weeks, and it was going to be an awful lot of money. So the way I did it was as rehearsed readings, where they all play the parts, almost like you're seeing a radio play on stage with the microphones and them all interacting. Because that way, if somebody couldn't do it, I can slot someone else in. And it means that we can have sporadic dates. So it means that what we've been doing is, we've done it at the Tron, we did it at Bad, done it at Irvine Celtic Supporters Club, done it at the Oran Mór, we've done it a number of places, but you can do like maybe three nights in a row and nothing for 2 weeks, then three nights in a row and then nothing, you know. You couldn't do that if it was a normal production. So there was a theatre that talked to us about doing it as a full production, but I felt for this year what we should do is try and take it out to Celtic Supporters Clubs if we can. So Irvine was amazing. Irvine is an incredible Celtic Supporters Club, I think, second only to Kirkluck in my opinion. So we're going out to Kirkluck, the Kirkluck Shamrock in August, and we've got them right through the year. We're going to the Beacon and Theatre in Greenock in November. So it's throughout the year. This Saturday we're at Kirkcaldy. Going out to Kirkcaldy. So we're making because of the way some of the actors are working on the Saturday, so there's a minivan taking some of them, but the rest of us are going to Bow Hill Cemetery to put flowers down at Johnny Thompson's grave, because we feel it'd be good to just say, yeah, that's not going either. And you know, the big important parts of your growing up and what Celtic means to you. Like, I'm going to bring my son, I want him to be there, and my daughter, because I've been there a couple of times, but it's a moving thing, and we just want to put something there for the Lions of Lisbon. And say it's the whole thing, isn't just about Lisbon. I mean, it's said in the play, it's about the whole thing. And Johnny Thompson's mentioned, you know. So what we'll end up doing is, we're doing Eastwood and East Kilbride, so there's quite a lot of other dates, but we're going to just try and film with any Celtic Supporters Club that wants to take it, that then understand it's 15 people you're bringing, so
yeah.
It's not cheap in terms of just even paying people for that night. But if you have a venue that can accommodate that and you'll sell it out, then we'll go there, whatever okay. It is. We're in the middle of talking to someone who offered to underwrite it for us to take it to Donegal for a week,
mm-hmm.
which is like that's where my mum's family's from, and that's where we always went on holidays, and I was there last year. That would be great. If we can see if we can do that, it would be perfect, and that's where I'd really like to take it.
So somebody did want to get in contact and did want at the supporters club, what would they do?
The best way to do it is to contact the company who's put it on. They're called Fair Play, and that's like F-A-I-R-P-L-E-Y.
Right.
Or A-Y.
Okay.
And it tells you our dates on there, and also the producers from there are the people to contact that'll be able to tell you what's possible and what isn't. And because, I mean, even just transporting all the musical equipment and all the mm-hmm. rest of it, if you're going to, say, Barra, we need to get it there.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to do it in Barra as well. I was in Barra. Barra's an amazing place recently, and I just thought, wow, imagine doing it here.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's no place that you can do it, as long as what we thought was if Celtic supporters clubs got together, three or four of them, so that it's not like one club on mm-hmm. one night, it makes it a more doable thing. People have came to see it with that in mind, so there's quite a lot of people talking about it. And for us, it's kind of an open thing. We'll see what happens. If we can bring it there, if they want it, we'll definitely try and do that.
Okay, so if people want to dig that out, go on so Fair Play,
yeah.
They can do that. The other thing I was just going to touch on, that you've sort of shed some light on here, every supporter of every football club thinks their club is different and special.
Mm-hmm.
But they're wrong, aren't they?
Yes.
What is it that makes... I mean, I don't want to... I mean, I know there is a story. There's a massive story in another football club in Glasgow of the last 5 years. It's a comedy, it's a tragedy, it's a brilliant... Yeah. I think it's a brilliant story to be done. I don't think they would be capable of doing it, of doing a true version of the events. Yeah. But what is it that you think that makes Celtic different? That we've got all of these stories and all of these plays and the musicals that have happened around the club, and
I don't know, because it's incredible. Even when I did the Celtic story, we were in Dublin for a month at the Gaiety Theatre, and there was people coming from like Cork, Donegal, Belfast, all over the place to come and see it. And the Liverpool board came over at the time to see the play, because they were thinking of doing a Liverpool version.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the Liverpool directors, we went to after the play, they invited the cast and all that to a club called Lily Bordello's in Dublin, that we all went to, and we're talking about what the play means, what it's like to do it in front of a Celtic audience, and they're talking about Liverpool,
mm-hmm.
who I think have probably one of the best histories of any club anywhere. They said, we don't have that same thing that you've got, whatever that is. We say there's something else goes on with Celtic, that we, but how do we tap into that? For Liverpool, we need to find a way to do that, because it's more than football. It's mm-hmm. What they're talking about is culturally, you know, you're getting into all the obvious stuff, but the fact that the club was founded the way it was, the kind of support it had, the people walking from, you know, from Glasgow to Dundee to see a game,
yeah.
all that is. And then, I mean, I know when we stopped 10 in a row, I was really emotional that day,
mm-hmm.
really, really emotional, because I was looking at the round the park, looking at where I stood when Celtic played 3-0 Madrid and beat them 2-0 with my dad, looking at folk who were no longer there, mm-hmm. Uncle Jerry, where I was with them, and the whole thing was overwhelming, because I think the passion for the club is a cultural thing. I mean, that I said recently on a, there was a thing at a Scottish book thing, where I said for many years I thought my identity was Celtic, not Scottish. I wouldn't have said it was Irish or mm-hmm. Scottish, I would have said it was Celtic,
yeah,
because there's a combination of both. I feel more Scottish now, because I think, yeah, I've definitely got an Irish heritage, but Celtic encompassed it more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it sounds a ridiculous thing to say a football team's your identity, but that's, if I'm being honest, that's probably the nearest to it that I could give. And there's not many football clubs. You're not going to say Wolverhampton Wanderers gives you, you know, my cultural identity.
No.
Or, and no offence to Wolverhampton Wanderers, but you know what I mean? It's, I think Celtic is it's, and it's, I think maybe the years that I've grown up, you know, I was born in the 60s, so that team were my childhood team. Celtic were one of the best teams in the world, if not the best, and to have grown up with that and then go through the hell that happened after that in the 9 in a row years, but going every year because you believed it's going to change and you know it'll change. And then Bill McNeil said in 88 there's a romance about this club, mm-hmm. when we did the double, and I think he's right, because I knew in my heart of hearts they might equal 9 in a row, they're not going to get 10, and then it's going to reverse. I felt that the whole way through, that's what's going to happen. Even when I was sitting, like the game when Paul McStay chucked his jersey in the jungle, I wouldn't leave. I was standing there, all my pals were going, this is ridiculous, you need to leave, and I was like, I'm going to leave. I don't know why that is that you just feel, no, this is more than football, whatever it is. It's definitely the amount of hours, money, life spent on them, it's more than football.
Do you know, it's interesting you say my cultural identity is Celtic, because you came here initially on the back of the Lions of Lisbon play and the 50th anniversary, and you saying that something that I thought was really, really important about the 50th anniversary was the 2-minute item on the national BBC news about the 50th anniversary of Celtic winning the European Cup, because it was one of the first times that it's not talked about within Scotland, but it was talked about nationally, that the importance of this result was not about Celtic winning the European Cup, it was about
a cultural
barrier, that the glass ceiling had been broken, that within Scotland you had Scottish people of Irish Catholic heritage who had a ceiling that they couldn't get past because that was their culture, and they broke it. And it taps into your comment there about it being your social cultural
identity. I mean, I remember, maybe it must have been 2000, it might have been when the Millennium thing was happening on Football Focus. The people on it were asked to talk about the greatest thing that had happened in the century, mm-hmm. football-wise, and obviously a couple of folks said England winning the World Cup, but I remember clearly Mark Lawrence talking about Celtic winning the European Cup, and talked about that as a cultural breakthrough. And also saying a thing that will never be achieved again. What Mark Lawrence said at the time, maybe he was just having a wee dig, was there's lots of people win the World Cup when it's in their own backyard. But he said Celtic went and won the European Cup not in their own backyard with 11 players who came from a 30 mile radius. That's never going to happen again. I remember thinking at the time, you're right, mm-hmm. that is enormous. That is. So all my pals that I have in London, that's what I continually say to them. Your World Cup's nothing compared to Celtic winning the European Cup. And I actually believe that. I'm not just kidding. Man.
So what's the next big story about our club?
I've been looking into, I don't know how to write it yet, but I've been looking into something that doesn't come across as all that funny, is the whole Celts for Change thing. Mm-hmm. Because that period of uncertainty with Fergus McCann, who I wasn't a great fan of at the time, but obviously really admire what he's done now, but at the time I just thought he was a rude wee man, I didn't like him, but I think he's amazing what he's done, but as somebody who's actually honest.
I was going to say, do you not think that rude wee man was because we were all told that people who say football clubs are like Robert Maxwell, David Murray, those types of people?
It's alluded to in the play now as we have it, is that the David Murray of that time to Celtic fans would have looked like a big shiny, oh my god, that's, we need something like that. But actually, as it says in the play, he's a Tory private school venture capitalist son of a bankrupt. Every single thing that's real about him is not what we should be about, mm-hmm. but we were looking for a person like that. We were wrong. Mm-hmm. What we actually got was somebody who came in and said, I'll tell the truth, and I'm going to tell you right now, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I want at the end. None of us liked hearing that, because there was no romance in that.
Yeah.
But in the end of the day, he did it, and he transformed the club. He's as big a figure as you have there now. Mm-hmm. So for all the personal, I mean, I met him a few times, I thought he was a nasty wee man, but I take my hat off to him. I think he did brilliantly for Celtic. Rangers have never had Endy with that honesty. Mm-hmm. Nobody in the entire history. I don't think. And I think at the time when the old board were going, when Michael Kelly was doing the death throes of We Made This Club, I wrote a letter into the Herald at the time. I was working for the BBC at the time, and my boss took me through and said, you shouldn't be writing letters like that. But I said, why not? I just work here. But the letter was written basically when he made his comment about these people from their peripheral housing schemes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or Celtic. So I wrote a letter calling him an incompetent descendant of a true Celt. So I paid for every game I went to. Many of you paid. Mm-hmm. My dad's paid for every game he's went to. My granddad paid for all the games he went to. We've put more money into the club than you've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you think you are? You know, so he made me really annoyed at the time, and I still think he doesn't get it either.
No, I don't think he does. Because even to this day, if he, we've had him on the podcast. I didn't do it. It was St. Anthony who spoke to him. It was like his recollection of events.
Oh, I know.
It's a fantasy recollection.
I know. So, but Fergus McCann coming in at that whole period, I think, is a really interesting period to write about. All those guys that did Celts for Change and the stuff that happened before Celts for Change were just ordinary guys. And I remember at the time being a real quandary as a fan about whether you do the leaving and not coming in.
The commandment game.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but I was like really feeling sick about what am I going to do.
I decided not to go and felt awful.
I went and left, mm-hmm. and I felt awful. I didn't know, because you're going, there's guys on the park, they have green white shirts on, and I'm walking away from them.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that those guys, Mark McGlone and all those guys, did an amazing thing, because in a way they, Fergus was the brain, did all the stuff, but they were the emotion and the heart of what happened. So I'd like to do something and try and capture that for like the young Green Brigade guys that are going now,
mm-hmm.
and say they're the original Green Brigade guys that I saw. It's in a different way, but their passion and what they did, I thought was immense.
Now people 30 and under will have no recollection of it.
They won't know that. No, I talked to my son who's a fanatic, and I've got like, I've got two sons, Sean and Michael. Sean loves music. My kid Johnny likes Arsenal, just to get up my nose. But, and so we brought him. He's been at a few Celtic games with me. And then,
when are you going to leave him on a hillside?
he's not really interested in football at all. He's like Celtic, but my son Michael he's a fanatic. And I've got a wee office space in the house where I've got all my memorabilia, including when I did the Celtic story, and it came out the cake, signed their chapter in the alphabet, the Celts.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a Lisbon Lions thing with all the Lisbon Lions signing it. Martin O'Neill thing when we won the treble, we signed by all the players and all that. And he'll just ask me questions when I bring up that period and try and talk about that. It just seems so alien to him.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, Celtic were like hours away from not being even Celtic anymore, and these supporters were off their own back having mass rallies and trying to galvanise the support, and remember as well people being dead against them. I remember the guy who was the head of the supporters clubs at the time,
mm-hmm.
having a full on row outside Celtic Park with all them saying they're betraying the club,
mm-hmm.
because and from his point of view that's how he felt. I can understand his point of view as well.
And there's a guy, Jerry McSherry, who used to write to the Evening Times all the time.
That's right, Jerry McSherry, that's right. But all that, I think that whole period of turmoil and all the rest of it is, sometimes I think those guys get left behind in the story,
mm-hmm.
which is why I'd like to write something about it, because I think they were a big part of the story. I mean, Fergus is immense in the story, but those guys deserve to be recognised. And I think a lot of them put trouble in their relationships and their working mm-hmm. lives. And I don't think it was easy. So I've got a plan to maybe try to think about doing something with them and about them next year.
And the only other thing in all of this, with all the books and the plays and musicals that have been written about the club, the one thing I think is always missing is Celtic the movie. And I actually think there's about 10 films in Celtic.
Yeah.
There is, in the way that there's all the plays that have been written.
No. I mean, I've been involved in a couple of early kind of discussions about trying to do something. And I always find the last one was to do with the Lisbon Lions thing coming up, and there was a potential film about that. And you actually go, well, how do you capture that? How do you capture what that is?
Yeah. Because a film's got to then appeal to not just
a Celtic audience. So in my my opinion is, don't try and recreate, and here's like, you know, somebody, Martin Compton as Billy McNeil, mm-hmm. or whatever. That wouldn't be the case, but you know, but the offence to Martin, who I know. But the idea
maybe Robbie Coltrane is
but I think doing a film about the fans, mm-hmm. and somehow then be able to do it through that, which is stories about the people who support them. They're the things that are the constant. I think there's a story in that, and I think there is a film to be made. I don't think you can do a film about the history of Celtic. It's impossible. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do it in a, well, not a drama. It just wouldn't work. You'd just be like, that's unbelievable, because a lot of the history has been unbelievable. Yeah. But I think that there are, as you're saying, maybe three or four films that could be done. Mm-hmm. I thought the documentary that the BBC did, John McLaverty did recently, was great. Mm-hmm. Did you see it?
I did, yeah, it was fantastic.
I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And I know that there's the Road to Lisbon documentary that's just been done with the guys who went over in the Hillman, uh-huh, yeah. and all that, which is getting edited at the moment, which I'm looking forward to seeing. But dramatically, if there's a drama about mm-hmm. Celtic, we'd just be choosing what bit. I know Peter Mullins talked about it several times. Mm-hmm. He would love to do something. It's about what would it be? And I think what you'd be thinking is, what would you choose from Celtic that you could do as a film that would appeal to a wider audience?
You look at, there have been, you know, plenty of films done in America about American football teams in particular.
Yeah.
It is always the equivalent of, it would have to be from, probably from 65 to 67.
Yeah.
That's the most cinematic storyline I can
think
of. I
mean, as soon as you do that, just from a producer's head, if I'm not thinking of my Celtic head, my producer head goes, right, that's a very expensive film, because mm-hmm. it's a period, you have to recreate that. That doesn't yeah. exist in Glasgow anymore. So you would go, right, how are you going to do that? You're talking about a build, you're talking about, suddenly that becomes a lot of money. So you'd have to have a story that justifies that money getting spent on it. So when you've got, like, for example, when, like, say Steven Spielberg does a war film, mm-hmm. or whatever he does, is always on a huge scale, because it yeah. justifies the money. So you'd have to go, right, well, what you can have is recreating period Glasgow and have a story about a family that like Celtic. You'd have to have something in that that's going to be big, you know.
Well, again, as soon as I say that, I think, well, again, what's the appeal to the outside audience? Well, the whole appeal of Celtic is, this is a team formed by immigrants who are yeah. disdained by society.
Yeah.
How do you give people the 2-minute synopsis to let them know that that's what's yeah. so special about winning the European Cup in 67?
Yeah, I know. I mean, my instinct at the moment is that I think the fact the whole immigrant thing is an interesting thing, because I think if you're an immigrant coming to our country now, you know, how is that? How are you received? Mm-hmm. You're getting the same stuff that happened to the people that came here that were immigrants, that are our ancestors. So there's, I think there's a definite connection there somewhere in Celtic. But I mean, it's a huge, I mean, I know that in the industry, I mean, there's loads of Celtic supporters. Uh-huh. Funnily enough, there's loads of actors, loads of writers and directors. In fact, when I was leaving the office today, I said I was coming to speak to you. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys in the office who's the production manager, Andy, who's a big blue nose, was like that. Well, it wasn't like before that, aren't he? You know, like, you know, he's not very many. But he was just joking about it, saying if you're doing a Celtic a Rangers film, you wouldn't have enough of your cast to do it. But yeah, I mean, I think something will happen mm-hmm. at some point. I mean, I know from previous experience that even raising the money for a film, I'm in the middle of raising money for a film out with what I do at the BBC at the moment, and but we're 18 months into the process at the mm-hmm. moment. It takes a long time, and you have to have something that will definitely want investors from other areas to put yeah. money into the film,
and they want a return on their investment. So you have to have it, getting back to the point, you have to have a story that's got a wider appeal.
It's got a wider appeal. Yeah. It's like the way, I mean, not that it's the best film in the world, but I still love it, is if you look at Rocky, the original Rocky film, mm-hmm. it was a really stroke of genius. He wrote that film in 3 days because he knew the story that he wanted to tell, which was based on Chuck Wepner,
yeah.
who fought Muhammad Ali. And then he told that story, and it had every single thing in that original film
you're like, aye, that's hitting a, it's not a boxing audience, it's going to this, here's a guy that's falling in love with a girl. Mm-hmm. He gets everything,
yeah,
very cleverly. I mean, the later Rocky films weren't brilliant, even though I've got a soft spot for them all. But that first one was tremendous, and you know, quite rightly won an Oscar. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and you're thinking, well, he managed to do a story that's about Chuck Wepner. If mm-hmm. you imagine your pitch was, I'm going to tell a story about Chuck Wepner, who's yeah. the guy who got battered after Muhammad Ali, the Bayonne bleeder who bled all the time. Mm-hmm. If you were going to pitch that, it'd be like that, right? If you're going to say, so this guy, underdog, who against all adversity, and the idea is that he doesn't win in the end, but he wins a girl,
mm-hmm.
then winning the girl was the big clever thing that he did in that film. And I think you'd have to find something with an angle. I mean, I meet Celtic supporters I know all the time that like, just tell it like it is, that's enough. And I'm like, well, yeah, for
it's,
us it is,
for us, aye, but you need to have it So what's the potential story for Celtic, the real story for Celtic in the coming seasons under Brendan? How do you see things going?
I mean, I'm living in the moment. When Brendan came, I was delighted. So I like Liverpool in England, and I think that I thought it was really great with Liverpool, and I liked him at Swansea before that. And I think the way he handles himself, I went down to the game when Celtic played Swansea in a pre-season friendly a mm-hmm. few years ago when Brendan was the manager yeah. there, and in the programme, and I talked about his love for Celtic in that programme. So I always knew he was a guy with Celtic at heart. But I have to say, I really never expected it to be as fantastically brilliant as it turned out, because I think it's transfer. I mean, I didn't dislike Ronnie Dyla. I just thought it stagnated,
mm-hmm.
And I felt as if that Neil Lennon, when he was there, there was all the kind of love that we have for him that helped. Mm-hmm. And I think Neil Lennon did a good job, and I think Ronnie Dyla did a decent job,
mm-hmm.
but I just think he was, you know, it was never going to go any further than where it was, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And Brendan came in, I expected to go a bit further and then see where it went after that. But I mean, I just think the fit between Brendan and the club and the supporters and the type of players that he's brought, but not just that, the players who are there, who are like fantastic. I mean, Kieran Tierney is amazing, and his father, Mick Tierney, was my class at primary school.
Right.
So it was me that told Mick. No, I was. but he was in my class at St Brendan's in Motherwell. And I mean, I love the fact that he's, I know he's from a total Celtic family. Yeah. He's living the dream. He's playing for the club he wants to play for. And then you're looking at players like Stuart Armstrong, who I think's come on like amazingly. You're going, what is it that Brendan's got that's done this? And there's, I think, the way he comes across, there's a genuine, I think, love for the players,
mm-hmm.
where what he's doing is, the club is really important, so are the fans, but he loves those players and he wants to get the best out of them. Like saying to Griffiths, trust me, I might be hard on you, but trust me, because I'm going to make you better.
Mm-hmm.
And then he scores there 2-3 kicks, which I think winged up a lot of folk that didn't know about him.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting Rangers signing the type of players they're signing, because I think what the manager there is trying to do is buy players that he trusts, mm-hmm. and he knows. So that, for a start, would tell you they would be a different proposition. What I think is that the fact that we haven't done any of that would tell me that Brendan's plans are going to come to fruition further down the line.
Yeah.
That it's going to get, I think the players he did sign have been sensational. And I can only see, touch my head here, my wood, is I can only see good in the next 4 or 5 years. I would like it to be more competitive. I would like range. I like being at the games where I'm going, oh my god, they've equalised,
mm-hmm.
and you're terrified about that, and then we score the winner or whatever, and that excitement's there, you know.
But, like the excitement of the cup thing.
I was tremendous. And I think I can just see good. I mean, I think his love for the club is genuine. I do think he'll get offers elsewhere, because I think he's going to be very successful here, but I think the fit for him at this point in his life is the right one. I don't doubt his love is genuine for the mm-hmm. club. It comes across as absolutely genuine. He's not kissing the badge, it's genuine. And mm-hmm. I think long may it continue. I mean, I was devastated when Martin O'Neill left, absolutely devastated, because I just felt oh, here's the end of something.
Yeah.
You know, something that's been probably one of the most special periods of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of like in the Lions of Lisbon, there's two actors who are both in Seville with me at that time. I'll never forget it. That was another extraordinary experience being a Celtic fan. I mean, I tried to write about that. My agent in London was like, "What is it you're trying to write?" And I was saying, "I'm not writing about the game. I'm trying to quantify what I witnessed, like walking through those squares with all the folk that were sleeping in the ground,
just moving people over so they weren't hanging on the road."
Exactly. Watch your leg there, pal. And just meeting folk you hadn't seen for 20 years. It was an incredible experience. But I stopped writing that after a while because I just thought, you can't quantify what that was. Mm-hmm. That's when you're talking about what was different from it being a football club. That was it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you ever quantify that or how anybody would ever know what it is unless you experienced it.
Yeah.
Because it was incredible. I think we'll have days like that under Brendan Rodgers.
Should I?
What I think. And what I would love to be able to do is bring my son, who loves the club, and my son, who's just like, right, because then he'll get to experience it, and my daughter, and my wife, and my mum, and my dad. I'd like to take them all so they get to feel what that's like. But certainly, I think for my son Michael, who's a fanatic, that he's got good days ahead coming with Brendan.
Okay, I think that positive, upbeat note is probably the best way to put it. Martin, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
Bring me sunshine. So I hope after listening to that you agree that it was a fantastic podcast. Again, if you can think of a song that starts better than Superstition, let me know. You're wrong. Anyway, let me know. Email in. You might be right, actually. I know. Sometimes I might be wrong. Anyway, get the emails in. Next podcast will be the Celtic Underground Top 10. Only thing I will tell you is somebody called Scott will be in the top two. And then after that, we'll have an interview with David Friel, who's written the book about the Invincibles season. And then we'll have more podcasts and stuff. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.